international finance markets, crisis, and law. We want to understand how markets have grown and changed, and then the specific size and values of the particular main markets that make up the international and domestic financial systems, and then how these have specifically moved in terms of recent changes in the markets, including particular important, significant geopolitical factors and geopolitical risks. So what we're going to look at is this: the international financial markets, and we'll consider this in terms of money and debt. We basically have, we had two worlds, we've now effectively got three worlds. We had a domestic mercantile economy, which was basically goods and products. And then we would trade that on a cross-border basis. So we created a global mercantile economy, an exchange economy, which we have had for the last almost 2,000 years, in different forms, in one form or another. On top of that, specifically since around the 16, 1700s, we have constructed a global financial economy. Now, these support each other, they work closely with each other, but to some extent we can almost separate this global financial economy as an investment environment in its own terms, in its own right. Basically, this is made up of a large number of investment classes, specific investment sectors, which have to a significant extent separated themselves from the underlying global mercantile economy. So we have a real world economy. On top of that, we've constructed this financial investment economy, and now, more recently, we're also building in a parallel or integrated, embedded part of that is this new idea of a digital or global economy, which will now become an artificial intelligence or artificial financial intelligence, AI and AFI economy as well. So we can understand the world in terms of these overlapping spheres of operation. Now, in terms of the main markets that make this up, we've got the banking markets, credit markets, and then we'll get the capital markets, and then other financial derivatives, foreign exchange, alternative investment markets, as well as insurance and commodity markets. This is a basic simplification. I have a number of other tables which look at all of this in further detail. They have all of the specific values and prices and changes, and we can understand how all of this comes together by comparing these. This is just to get an initial impression, overview of the different types of market classes that we're looking at. The banking markets themselves are essentially debt-based. It's either one bank or a group of banks called a syndicate lending to one borrower or a group of borrowers. It's bilateral, direct credit relationship, it's debt-based, and the principal risk is called credit risk. That's the risk of counterparty default. That's the risk that the borrower will not pay interest during term and repay principal on maturity. The capital markets are indirect. In this case, we embed the payment obligation in the form of a security, and we're buying and selling the securities. So capital markets are securities-based. These are transferable securities, which are also negotiable. Transferability means you can transfer something. Negotiability means you can transfer it with perfect legal title so that the person acquiring the asset has perfect legal title so long as they did so without any notice of defect in the transferee's title. This goes back to the bills of exchange market in Italy in the 12, 13, 1400s when we go back to the great fairs. Merchants had to be able to trust each other, and they had to be able to pass on instruments. So they needed to know that they could get perfect title, legal title to an asset without that being impinged, undermined by someone else's claim against that. For example, a banknote is negotiable. It doesn't matter if the banknote was stolen. If you acquired the banknote without any notice of the person who held it before, without any prior notification of their defect in title, you can acquire perfect title. So you're dealing in negotiable instruments all day, every day of your life. The same thing happens in these international markets. The bond markets, they're negotiable. These, strictly speaking, they're bearer instruments, which means they're made available to the holder They're not what we call registered instruments, so that they're registered to a specific title holder, as you would with a share or an equity interest on a company register. The bond markets tend to be bigger so that anybody can hold them, and then they can pass perfect title in these markets. The banking markets include both the money markets and then the other credit markets. The money markets are wholesale markets for up to 1 year, dealing in money market instruments, principally things like bills of exchange, letters of acceptances, other instruments that wholesale financial parties would hold, including sort of commercial paper and certificates of deposit. All of this is explained in the chapter 1, 2, and in the introduction. Money markets are wholesale markets. There's a primary money market and a secondary money market, which are shown on the table. The primary money market is the market in which the central bank intervenes in any economy with a small group of specialized counterparties, principally to control monetary policy. Monetary policy is very simple. It simply means controlling the volume and cost of money in circulation within the economy. It's controlling the price and amount of money in circulation. The central banks do that by lending and buying assets from the small group of counterparties in the money market, and through that it can control the volume of credit available and the price of that credit. That's how it's passed on. In the United Kingdom, this is called the discount market, because it was the discount houses that the Bank of England originally dealt with on a more specialist limited basis. And the rate's called the bank rate. And by controlling the bank rate, dealing with a small group of specific specialised institutions in the discount market, the Bank of England, as the central bank, can then manage the cost, supply and circulation of money across the rest of the system. The secondary money market are these other markets for other specialist assets in the wholesale money markets up to 1 year, other than in the discount market. These include in the United Kingdom the local authority market, the finance house market, the sterling interbank market, the interbank market, and the sterling certificate of deposit market. Again, all of this is dealt with in the paper. The history of the Eurodollar market then is the Eurodollar markets are specialist international loan markets that operate on a cross-border basis. These emerged after the Second World War, and they themselves specifically consist of three particular markets. There's an underlying interbank market again, and like the domestic sterling interbank market, the interbank market is simply an operation, set of structured arrangements whereby the banks can buy and sell money amongst themselves. So we have a sterling interbank market, but we also have a separate Eurodollar interbank market that supports the Eurodollar system. That's the market into which specifically the American banks will bring dollars from North America. They bring it to London and then they lend it to other institutions through the Eurodollar interbank market. So there's a sterling interbank market in the UK domestic system, and then a separate Eurodollar interbank market. It's also called the placement and taking market, which underlines the Eurodollar system. On top of that, within the Eurodollar system then, we have the syndicated lending market, and we have the Eurobond market. And again, as I've said before, in the syndicated lending market, in this case, what we simply have is we have groups of banks, syndicates, lending to borrowers, and usually not just one, but a large group of borrowers. Why? It's not because the bank can't afford to lend, it's that the bank wants to spread the risk. And spread what? Spread the credit risk. The bond market, we transfer the debt, we embed the debt in the form of a transferable and negotiable security. In this case, the risk isn't the credit risk, the risk is what we call market or position risk. And that's the risk that the value of the asset will rise or fall in the markets. So we buy at one price, we sell at another, we've either made a profit or we've made a loss. We call that market or position risk. What we'll see, there's also a whole series of other more specialist financial risks. If we have interest rate assets with an interest rate exposure, we have interest rate risk. We may have currency risk in relation to financial derivatives. There's a whole series of risks that we classify in terms of Greek lettering. So we talk about the alpha, the beta, the delta, and the theta, and that's all in the separate papers provided on the system. The basic history of the euro-dollar system is having euro loans initially for extended periods, maybe 20 years, between 2 and 10 banks, let's say 100 million. What would then happen very shortly after that is we have the emergence of the euro bond market. In that case, we can borrow the same, raise the same, this time by selling bonds into the market for the same duration, let's say 20 years, at almost the same coupon in the early markets, although a little less. The subsequent history of the capital markets and the bond market specifically has then been one of shorter duration. So instead of having long 20-year bonds, fixed note interest bonds, we have shorter medium-term notes, 5, 10, 15-year. We have short euro notes, 1, 2, 3. And then if it's less than 1 year, we call that paper. So we have paper up to 1 year, notes generally between 1 and 20 years, and then bonds 20 years longer. You can have some shorter bonds, you can have some longer notes. The legal distinction between the note and the bond, nevertheless, is that a note has floating rate interest, a bond has fixed rate interest. The structured finance markets, these are basically a specialist form of securitization. Securitization allows us to take assets on the banking side and transfer that to the capital market side. We do that very simply. We sell pools of credit assets which are governed by identical terms, so it becomes a single legal portfolio. We can sell those to a special purpose vehicle that we set up solely to buy that pool. And how does that SPV pay for that? It issues new notes into the market. So we essentially convert economically underlying credit risk assets, we turn them into notes. The underlying pool could be residential mortgages, corporate real estate, student loans, car loans, finance instruments. That pool we transfer, convert into notes by using an intermediate SPV. The structured finance market also includes secondary securitization or re-securitization, which is the basis for collateralized debt obligations, collateralized bond obligations, collateralized note equity obligations as well, which is essentially a re or secondary securitization of the note program once it's been created after the original securitization. They also then have, as we mentioned already, financial derivatives markets, futures options and swaps, as well as credit derivatives from the 1980s onwards, and then hybrid instruments. The derivatives really expand from the collapse of the Bretton Woods fixed currency system at the beginning of the 1970s. All of the new main forms of over-the-counter, OTC, and exchange-traded derivative instruments, they all begin in the early 1970s. We had the Bretton Woods system, which was agreed in July 1944, just before the end of the Second World War. We create the International Monetary Fund to manage monetary stability. We create the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, which becomes the World Bank Group, to support development finance. We were going to establish an international trade organization, an ITO. That wasn't agreed. So we have the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the GATT, the GATT, in its place, which is then subsumed in the larger World Trade Organization trade system in 1995. That was the Bretton Woods system. It also established a new dollar exchange gold standard, whereby we fix the value of the dollar to gold at $35 per ounce, and all of the other currencies in the world are fixed to the dollar, subject to a formal exchange and adjustment mechanism. That system is what allowed us to rebuild all of the major economies in the world after the Second World War. The protection and the stability that that dollar system created. That lasts until 15 July 1971. The then President Richard Nixon announced in a radio address about the new economic policy, principally because of a dilution in the US gold reserves, because of the gold system that we operated, and because of the pressure of the Vietnam War. Nixon announced at the end of his address, "Oh, and we are going to close the gold window." That meant that other countries could no longer exchange dollar bills for gold bullion. So this terminated that fixed exchange rate system. There was a committee of 20 established to try and create a new system over a two-year period. They couldn't agree on anything, so we move on to fully floating currencies from 1973-1974 onwards. The new world that we live in, with high levels of currency volatility and interest rate volatility, all goes back to these events at the beginning of the 1970s. And the financial derivatives market as a whole is largely a response to that increased volatility in the markets. Just to give some idea of size, coins and banknotes, it was sitting around $5 trillion for some time. The total value of the world I'm going to come on to cover is now $1.54 quadrillion. And if we net all of the debt down and we take a total clean net figure, $510 trillion. Within that, coin and banknotes, it was about $4, $5 trillion. That's since gone up to about $8 trillion. That contrasts with banknotes, total banknotes and accounts in the world are about $90 trillion. Banknotes and coinage has traditionally only been about 4 or 5% historically of actual money. And legally, money is not money. Coin and banknotes are money in law because they are official reference assets denominated in, they are items denominated in an official reference currency, an official reference asset, which is the local currency, fiat currency of the particular country. Banknotes technically are not money. They are in economic terms, but legally they cannot be, because all a bank account is a claim for value against the account provider, the bank. And whether the bank is transferring money between accounts within its own bank system, between its own customers, or with other customers, or globally, there is nothing actually in the bank account. There's nothing actually in the bank account. An account is only a claim for value. It's only a debt obligation by the account holder against the bank. And this was actually confirmed in a series of leading legal cases. It was an important judgment of R versus Prudy, 1996, House of Lords, which confirmed that you cannot steal anything in a bank account under the Theft Act 1968 because there is nothing in the account to steal. This then led to the Theft Act being changed and revised following a Law Commission report, so that now interfering and receiving funds by deception is theft, but it wasn't before because there's nothing in the bank account to steal. A bank account only holds evidences the debt, the claim by the account holder against the bank. When you're transferring money overseas, you do that through what's called the SWIFT system. The SWIFT system is simply a cryptographically secure messaging instruction system whereby one bank agrees to reduce or increase an account value while the other bank agrees to correspondingly increase or reduce the account in another bank in another country, possibly in another currency. All you are doing then is adjusting account balances over banks. That's how you transfer funds. You don't actually transfer any assets. It's only the claims against the bank themselves which are adjusted. That's why the bank account system is almost genius in its simplicity of operation. But there's some important legal issues that we have to identify and be clear about. There is nothing actually in the bank account. The bank account in law cannot be money as such because it's only a claim against the bank. You transfer assets by adjusting account holdings between the banks. Can account holder insist on being paid in cash rather than have the bank simply transfer value, even if it's a very large value? We also know from separate case law that the account holder can insist on a cash payment. That was the Libyan foreign asset case, when assets were held both in New York and in London. There was a dispute with the Libyan government, the country of Libya. They insisted on the repayment of funds both in New York and in London, and the courts in London confirmed that that had to be repaid, and it had to be paid in cash in that particular case because there was no alternative agreement which said that there could not be any payment by transfer or payment through cash, and therefore the account holder was entitled to insist on a cash payment, even though the total amount was around $319 million. dollars. We can then see some of the other values of key markets in the world. Euro dollars, 223 trillion. Bonds, 128.3 trillion. Securitization, 1.6 trillion. Financial derivatives. I'd given three figures there. 600, this was about 19, this is 2019, I think, around there. $600 trillion. This is now one quadrillion. The total size of the global derivatives markets is over one quadrillion. However, we can actually identify three separate figures. The 600 trillion is the actual nominal value. When we calculate futures, options, and swaps, we have a larger amount against which we calculate the amount that we're dealing with. That's the nominal figure. The amount actually at risk, which can be paid and transferred, is only about maybe 6%, 5, 6% of that, so 15.8 trillion. Although 600 trillion sounds like a very large amount of money, the amount that you would actually pay in practice is going to be much less than that. 15 up to 20, 25, 30 most. If you then apply the separate netting provisions and the adjustment clauses which the private documentation provides for because of the use of clever legal documentation, that comes down again. So the total figure again is only about 3, 4, 5, 6% of that. So in a total market worth $600 trillion, you've only actually got maybe $15 to $20 trillion at risk. And then in terms of the actual payments that you will make in practice, it's only $3.4 trillion. So you reduce a $600 trillion market to $3.4 trillion through the use of well-drafted, intelligent, legal documentation. We then have insurance markets attract between about 5.5 trillion in premia. That's the payments that are made either initially or on an ongoing basis each year. That's now gone up to about $7.3 trillion. The point is the insurance companies and other similar businesses like unit trusts, mutual funds, other asset holders, these are the largest investors in the world. What they do is they take that insurance premia, then they invest into the rest of the market, including the bond market for safe, secure, stable amount of investment, as well as the equity market, safe, stable, as well as they'll take on higher risk equities as well, but also there'll be financial derivatives investment, possibly structured finance and other asset classes they will look at as well. Shipping markets are worth around $14 trillion, silver markets around $5 trillion, gold markets just under $12 trillion at this time. As I said before, what's the world worth? I had different figures before. Just before the global financial crisis, the total figure was $194 trillion. Following the global financial crisis, that collapses to about $178. That then recovers by 2020 to $431 trillion. That includes $250 trillion in financial assets, $235 in real assets, $53 in other liabilities. The total figure now is $1.54 quadrillion. If we net that down, the total value of all the assets in the world is still $510 trillion, which means as a civilization, our species has over its 10,000 years of existence created $510 trillion worth of value in financial terms. In terms of total debt, the total global figure, I think just now is about $305, $307 trillion. But as I've said, if we take the latest total asset figure and we net that down, we still get $510 trillion net. These are just other figures which explain how the debt volumes have grown and have increased over time. The total Federal Reserve balance sheet's around $9 trillion just now, up from well under $1 trillion before the global financial crisis. Total US debt's about $31, $33 trillion. Total China government debt's about $15 trillion, although total debt, including all the municipality debt in China, is more like $40 trillion. With a property market worth between $52 and $54 trillion and in a very volatile condition at this time. Could we have further crisis? Could we have further instability? What have we got? Historic high levels of debt, rising inflation and interest rates, coronavirus costs, climate costs, technology crisis costs possibly, complex causation and emergence, endogenous internal risks, exogenous external risks, and potentially existential risks, which threaten the stability of everything. More specifically, we've got the China Evergrande sitting on $310 billion worth of debt. China real estate, we've mentioned, $52 to $55 trillion in a somewhat precarious condition. We've also got problems with China electricity, cost and supply, UK gas and energy costs, as well as United States commercial real estate market. There's a 70% chance of a collapse in that market. How is that going to impact financial markets more generally? What we can do is this. We can understand a lot of the principal asset classes and investment areas through this simple slide here. We've got the S&P, Standard & Poor's, which is the main market in the United States, originally set up, I think it was 1957. The Dow Jones, it goes back to 1896, with the Dow Jones Company originally being set up in 1882. The NASDAQ is an electronic exchange system in America, so these are the three largest exchanges in America. The NASDAQ was only set up in 1971. It's an electronic system whereby we took everything off the physical stock markets and exchanges with the old trading pits, and we put everything online. We made it all electronic. We did that as early as 1971 with the NASDAQ. So the three major markets in America are the S&P 500, the Dow Jones, and the NASDAQ. In the UK, it's the UK FT 100, or even with also the separate, there's a 250 and a 500. So the UK FT Financial Times 100, that was set up in 1935. Globally, we also have the Hang Seng in Hong Kong, that was 1933. And then we have the Shanghai Composite, is the main Chinese stock market, that was 1990. What we also do is this, we look at the bond prices. We used to look at the old 30-year bond. Now the principal reference asset is the US 10-year bond. We've also got the 5-year and the 2-year. What tends to happen is bond prices are inverse. As the bond price collapses, the yield goes up. Because the yield is basically the coupon rate divided by the price times 100 over 1. So what happens is when the bond markets are in difficulty, in flight, as they are just now, so they've been collapsing over the last 2 years, we've not had a massacre, but with a substantial decline, what that means is this: the price of the bonds goes down, so the yields go up. So it's an inverse relationship. And we can see how that's moved. And we'll see there, the UK 10-year used to be 1%. The US 10-year was 1.47%. I'm going to show you what they are today in a couple of minutes. The Japanese has been very low for the last 10 years, almost 20 years, at 0.04%. That's the lowest in the world. The German 10-year is always very low as well, 0.23. Let me just highlight a couple of other things. The dollar sterling is one of the most important exchange rates. We call that the cable rate. When they talk about the cable, they mean dollar sterling. It can be dollar sterling, it's down to like 0.74, or sterling dollar is more commonly used in the UK. You start with the sterling first because it's higher. It's been about 1.27, 1.2, today I think it's 1.24. You've also got other key rates, so you've got the euro dollar and the dollar euro. Remember, if you divide one by the other, or the other by the first one, by the second, or the second by the first, the figure changes. Dollar yen, you've also got, we look at oil, Brent crude, we look at the NYMEX, and the NYMEX is usually calculated on West Texas Intermediate, which is the WTI. So oil prices are either UK Brent, which is the Brent oil field in the North Sea, or it's WTI, which is West Texas, where most of the oil is provided in the United States. And that's traded on the New York Mercantile Exchange, the NYMEX. Brent crude, it was down at 78. That has gone back up to 84, even following the most recent disruption. It's still only about 85 today. It has been as high as 90, almost 100, over 100. If, so long as we can keep that around about 80, 90, the oil prices are fairly stable. Gold, that's the price per troy ounce, and then silver, and the price as well. What we'll show is how these have been moving with the more recent instability. These were the prices about a year ago. We can see how each of these has moved. Generally, I mean, pretty stable, a lot of them rising. what we've actually had is stock markets, global stock markets have actually been very strong, surprisingly strong for recent years. Bond prices have, however, started to collapse, and as the bond prices go down, the yields go up, and we can begin to see that. Now, what we can do is this. This table, we can see how everything's moving as of last week. So, again, there is some recovery in the US equity prices. These have been surprisingly strong. The biggest problem that the Federal Reserve has had in the United States is that the equity market's been very strong, and that the consumer position, the financial condition of the consumer in the United States has been much stronger than expected. Following the coronavirus crisis, there's been a lot of debt paid off and a lot more savings. So what the American Federal Reserve Bank has found out is that even by putting interest rates up, it's not pushing inflation down because of the power of the American consumer. So what that's going to mean is that we're going to have higher interest rates for longer. I don't have time to get into all of this in detail. What actually happened was before the global financial crisis, central banks were looking at the wrong inflation. They were very proud that they kept consumer price inflation very low, but that's eggs, bread and milk. They weren't watching house price inflation, which rocketed out of all control. The problem now is that with the very substantial rise in oil and gas prices, is that the consumer has no control over that. So by increasing interest rates to try and counter inflation, you're trying to counter a rise in oil and gas prices, which is a cross-border international supply issue that has nothing to do with domestic consumers having to pay very high interest rates on their borrowing, on their loans, and on their mortgages, because there's no correlation whatsoever. Those are the two major problems just now. Because of what had happened during the 1980s, in particular with the then chairman of the Federal Reserve, Paul Volcker, who was in office for around 8 years, between around 81 to 88, he put interest rates up in America to 20% to try and get inflation out of the system. And that was penal, in particular, on households and consumers. A lot of the main central bank governors in the world have said the same thing, whether it's Christine Lagarde of the European Central Bank, Bailey at the Bank of England, Jay Powell at the Federal Reserve. They've said, we will get inflation down. What does that mean? Just endlessly increase interest rates, punish the economy. What they're trying to do is they're trying to push it down to just above recession. They don't want to cause a recession, but just above that, they want to try and contract, squeeze the economy as hard as they can to try and exclude, reduce this inflation. Now, the biggest problem that we have with bond prices just now is that we have an inverted curve. Now, normally with bond prices, the curve, the yield curve goes up. It rises longer term because the prices will go down, the yield goes up. What's happening is the short rates, the 2 and the 5 year rate, are now higher than the 10 year. We have an inverted yield curve. What that means is we're heading for a recession. The markets and the economists are pricing in a recession, either in America or Europe or other parts of the world. And the biggest problem we have now is that if the central banks push this inflation, combating, attacking too hard, they're going to push us into recession. The negative yield curve, the inverted yield curve, says we're heading for a recession. And you can see that in the price of the US 2, 5, and 10 year bonds. But you'll just see how high these bond prices have risen. In 3 years, the US 10 year has gone from 1.47 up to 4.58. The United Kingdom, I showed you this figure before, was less than 2. It was 1.23 or something. It's now at 4.37. It's still less than America, but it's very high. And if we compare that, for example, with the German 10-year, it's gone from 0.23 up to 2.85. And then the Japanese, 0.04% up to 0.74%. So very substantial rise. The point is this, bond prices are collapsing, so the bonds are cheaper. And because the yield's calculated with the coupon against the price, you have this invert relationship. There's different types of bond prices that we can calculate. We talk about, for example, we have the bond yield, the coupon rates, that's the simple one I described already. We talk about the current yield, We talk about the yield to maturity. We talk about the effective annual yield, effective nominal yield. There's different ways of calculating this, but we can watch it change over time. We can also see on the foreign currencies the cable rate. So cable went from 1.16. Sterling was at 1.27 a couple of months ago. It dropped about 1.21. Today it's 1.24. It's actually pretty stable. It's held pretty well. Gas prices substantially went up. Oil went up to 89.90. I think it was almost 100 at one point. It was back to 94. I think today it's down to 85, which is surprising in terms of the most recent disruption we've seen in the markets. Gold price per ounce has been rising. It's gone up from 146 to 154. And price of silver has gone down. What we can generally see overall is that markets have been relatively stable, even with all the geopolitical risk that was caused through the Russian unauthorized illegal invasion of Ukraine on 24 February 2022, and then with the further disruption caused by the insurgents with Hamas in Israel in October 2023, the markets have been relatively stable at this time. One of the important ways to look at this is called the VIX index. The VIX is the volatility index. It's essentially calculated on the basis of the Chicago options prices, which are calculated on the S&P option price. So these are the S&P prices here. You've got a separate S&P option price, which is how it's expected to move and go in the future. The VIX is calculated on the basis of a 30-day projection on the S&P 30. This is called the fear index or the fear gauge. This is how markets perceive things are going to come in the future. Surprisingly, the VIX is low. The VIX was at 31.69 about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, during the coronavirus crisis. It's now down to, it was at 18.36, it's now about 19 today, 19.21. So the markets don't actually expect major instability going forward at this stage. You've also got what's called the VVIX. Now the VVIX is a volatility rate on the VIX itself. So the VIX is a volatility of the S&P, which is a proxy for the American stock market and the American economy. And then you've got a volatility on the volatility, the VVIX and the VVIX, right? The VVIX is about 91. The VVIX has been up to, I think the highest figures I had were, the VVIX went up to 168 in 2020, the heart of the coronavirus crisis. So it's down at 91. That's remarkably stable. And then the VIX, its high during the global financial crisis, 2008, was 59.89. So almost 2.5 times higher than today. So the markets are in a remarkably stable and healthy condition, in particular having regard to all of the wider geopolitical instability we're looking at across the world just now. How can we understand change in the markets? What we can do is this. In the post-war period, and in particular from the 1970s onwards, we can summarize this very quickly. Cross-border expansion, massive development improvements in computer hardware and software, very substantial corresponding advances in telecommunications, 1G, 2G, 3G, 4G, 5G, 6G, complex groups construction, legal deregulation across the world, in particular with restoration of currency convertibility, and then capital mobility, in particular, led by the British and then the Americans at the end of the 1970s, beginning of the 1980s. We can see this in terms of market growth, and we'll come back and mention all of these markets specifically, with the rise in securitization markets in the 1970s, disintermediation markets 1980s, product innovation and repackaging 1990s, the privatization of markets, that's when markets become OTC, over-the-counter. Private equity firms, for example, we don't want to invest in exchange-traded companies because they're subject to public company law, which is very onerous, much more expensive, much more difficult, much more complex. So very often, if you're a private equity company, you go in, if the company's already listed, you delist it. You take it off the stock market. And we're doing that with a lot of other asset classes. We're taking debt off markets so that we can trade them OTC in private markets. So there's a substantial move to privatization rather than sort of officialization, nationalization of assets. And we've seen that from the 1990s, 2000 onwards. And then larger deconstruction of risk. We're no longer looking at risk in simple, basic terms, financial risk, credit risk, market risk, interest rate risk. It's a much more complex system now, much more complex analysis, and with very sophisticated algorithms and probabilistic systems, which break all the risk down into different asset classes, very fine divisions. And what we then do is we design assets to match that. So a lot of what happened with the structured finance market, and in particular credit default swaps, collateralized debt obligations, CDOs, and credit default swaps, CDSs, a lot of that was about creating very finely defined grades of risk. So what would happen is if you had a $100 billion CDO, you wouldn't just issue one set of notes into the market, you'd issue a whole tranche. You'd have mezzanine in the middle, high risk and low risk, and maybe 10 up to 30 different tranches of risk. Each of these would have a very specific risk premium attached to it and risk definition with a corresponding risk payment. And that's what we talk about in terms of deconstruction of risk. Markets are much more sophisticated than they've ever been before. We don't look at risk in simple, basic classes anymore. We break it all down. We look at asset classes as a whole, and we analyze and develop very complex models to understand and deal with all of this in practice. Since the post-global financial crisis changes, what else have we had? Market contraction, substantial restructuring, a lot of increased market competition and profitability. A lot of this was driven by central banks initially with QE, quantitative easing, as relaxing conditions, and then QT, which is what we're now going through as they battle with rising inflation. We've got quantitative tightening. Essentially, we created this massive global wall of liquidity before the global financial crisis. By 2007, we had almost perfect market conditions. You could borrow almost unlimited amounts of money anywhere in the world, for any purpose, at almost zero cost. It was nirvana. That all collapses during the global financial crisis. But what's then happened is central banks have reinflated this massive global wall of liquidity through quantitative easing, QE. The problem now is, because of the commodity oil and gas disruption following the invasion of Russia into Ukraine in February 2022, and then with Hamas in Israel in October 2023, we're seeing massive rise in inflation. So the central banks are being forced to increase rates, increase interest rates to deal with inflation, counteract inflation, which is quantitative tightening. So we're replacing this massive global wall liquidity. We're contracting all of that now. We're going from QE to QT. It took 12 years. It had to happen at some point. It's just, we're going through it. It will be painful, but we will get through this. A lot of market criticism, a lot of overregulation, a lot of market reaction, and then a lot of deregulation. We reacted too quickly. We overregulated, then we're now underregulating, now we're having to try and think about re-regulating again. But with all of this, we've had continuing market innovation, market growth, and market advance. In terms of how things are changing overall, we still have basically have a dollar-based system with dollar hegemony. Number of people criticize this, don't think it's appropriate. Whether you adhere fully to all aspects of domestic, US domestic and foreign policy, this has still been very valuable for the world as a whole over the last 70, 80 years since the Second World War. That's what's created the stability and allowed for the globalization movements and the very substantial advances that every part of this world has enjoyed for the last 70, 80 years, specifically countries like China. China would not have been able to grow and prosper if it had not been for the stability that this system has created. Now, a lot of calls have been made for changing this. I've given you some figures here and in the documents which I provide supporting this, specifically a paper I wrote on dollar hegemony. United States, we're controlling 23% of GDP, 12% of trade, although 60% of investment assets are managed on a dollar basis. The Americans are still managing between 44 and 55% of assets all around the world. It's been going down. There's been instability. There's been a lot of increased criticism, but it tends to be not so much in monetary terms, more in terms of political aspects and political action. There have been a lot of calls for the establishment of new alternative systems, but nothing so far has really proven to be of any real value, of any real possibility. The euro's not stable and secure enough. We cannot even begin to consider the Chinese renminbi until it's fully floating and the Chinese authorities open up stock markets, currency markets and investment markets fully. There is no other real alternative. Writers, commentators such as Mark Carney, the former governor of the Bank of England, has recommended the establishment of some form of synthetic hegemonic currency. That basically means taking, my opinion, and this is my model, is taking something like the International Monetary Fund. It has an SDR, special drawing rights. It's effectively an embryonic model global currency. The only difference is we could digitalize that, turn it into a cryptocurrency, effectively a digital currency. There's other recommendations we could make in terms of, for example, you'll see top right there, the United States increasing its funding for the International Monetary Fund. Could America surrender its veto? Highly unlikely, but it's for discussion. Extend swap lines. During the global financial crisis and then the coronavirus crisis, how did the Federal Reserve save the world? By extending massive swap lines to all the other central banks in the world so they could draw down. It made available $1 trillion through swap lines because everybody needed dollars because most of the large markets in the world are all denominated and operated in dollars. So we need to extend these swap lines. Have a more formal system, for example. Encourage large banks to have United States operations so they can access dollars when they need them. Remove political and regulated interference. That's one of the main criticisms. That dollar access can be abused, although you form your own opinion. Were the sanctions imposed on Russia, was that an abuse or a proper application of a legitimate monetary tool that Western allied countries have? And then it's the same when you consider other rogue territories such as North Korea, and then possibly thinking about other countries that might be subject to some sanction going forward. And then larger reform of international financial institutions. We've already mentioned the veto at the IMF. A lot of people object to that, but also we could carry a lot of other improvements in terms of trade relations. The Doha round international trade negotiations have essentially collapsed just before and certainly since the coronavirus crisis, and now with all this geopolitical risk. Trade helps countries grow. Trade helps everybody prosper. Trade brings shared wealth benefits to everyone. And if we're going to close up and create an increasingly fragmented world, it's going to make everything increasingly difficult and more expensive and unpleasant for everyone across the world. Just in terms of some idea of market size and market costs, I've summarised the global financial crisis, the coronavirus crisis, and also built in possible anticipated climate crisis costs, and then further future exogenous or potentially existential threats. Total global financial crisis, anything at minimum between 2 and 4.6 trillion. I've seen figures estimate that to be as high as $16 trillion. Coronavirus crisis, IMF figure, the most reliable data I could find, $12.5 trillion. Global climate crisis, what's that going to cost us? Up to $178 trillion over 50 years. Now, the point simply is, can markets withstand this? Can markets handle this? Yes. They've proven themselves to be relatively, remarkably stable, sound, and be able to continue to deliver even during the coronavirus crisis. We essentially suspended the market model, the private market model, had managed market systems, whereby we had people being paid directly by governments under furlough schemes with a whole series of other support operations adopted, massive collapse in tax revenue, massive collapse in bank returns and bank payments with an increase in credit risk and interest rate risks, and the banks and the financial system still managed to get through that. We've also been able to so far still deal with the geopolitical risk created by the events in Russia and so far the events in Israel. The markets have been remarkably stable and remarkably solid through all of this time. My own opinion is, I'm very optimistic. I think technology will come through. I think we will see massive advances, in particular with blockchain, graph technology, distributed ledger technology, artificial intelligence, artificial financial intelligence, cybernetics, biotech, nanotech. I think we're going to see massive advances, massive improvements in all of this. And we're going to have the market system and the funds ready and available to invest and support all of this. Once all of this begins to come through, I think we're looking at a new, more stable, more prosperous era coming. It might take 2, 3, 4, 5 years. It might take 10 years, but I can see a very positive technology-driven future ahead. We just have to bring it forward as quickly as we can. Hopefully it will only be 2, 3 years. Hopefully we can get past a lot of this instability as quickly as that. But it depends upon larger external geopolitical factors that we just have to watch. All I've listed at the bottom here then are just future possible threats. I actually turn this into a model. So S is social, M is market, or T is trade. Climate is atmospheric, infrastructure, regulation and technology, and then warfare becomes S for stability, security. That becomes SMARTS or STARTS. Smarts, starts, charts and scarts. So a lot of the separate papers that I've provided on the system, I construct this exogenous and existential risk model to try and anticipate, manage all possible future exposures. We can develop effective, necessary systems. You'll also see in the papers I've got, I want a new international treaty. I want a GIFTA, GIFT, Global Investment Finance Treaty. I want a GREAT, Global Reciprocal Economic Area Treaty. We take all the best of the European system with mutual recognition, minimum harmonization, home country control. We create a new international trading model. And then also a GILT, Global Investment Law and Technology Treaty, and a GATE, Global Artificial Intelligence Treaty. With all of these things, we can set up a new international, technology-driven, more safe, more stable global order. We just need to get past the current monetary instability and geopolitical unrest disruption that we've got. But I think we have a longer, more positive future ahead. Markets usually go up and down. We're at the peak of a disruption. I think everything will recover. I think everything will come together over time. And hopefully, we have the responsibility, we have the political commitment, and we have the larger will to make this work. We have one future. We have one opportunity. We have one common responsibility.